For the week of July 30th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 375, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at Hogwarts, I'm Michael Giltz.
You know what? I don't even want to ask why you're at Hogwarts now. I have absolutely no
idea.
Do
you have to ask?
You know what? I know that some of our listeners think that we plan this all out each week, but literally every week you just pick someplace and then you're there. And I have no idea why, unless it's something like, you know, you're in.
It's all pre-approved travel budget stuff. So, you know, it's not like I do this willy-nilly. I have to get it planned in advance, book the flight, get there. First of all, everyone knows J.K. Rowling announced two more charity books, sort of spin-offs for Harry Potter. Not proper novels. They're just little fun little things to raise money for charity. I think in this case, the British Library. But that's not why I'm at Hogwarts on July 31st.
Oh, of course.
We're recording Harry Potter's birthday.
Okay, yes, that makes
sense. He was born on July 31st, 1980, and he shares a birthday with J.K. Rowling.
Oh, really? Okay, well, here's a question. What day did he get the scar? There's a trick question for you.
I don't know.
Wasn't it the day he was born?
I don't know. I don't think he came out of his mother's womb and then Voldemort attacked. No, but I don't know that. I think he was a little baby.
Okay, I can't believe you said the name who shall be not mentioned, the Voldemort guy.
Well, I know he's a fan of the show because he likes to stay informed on the box office and villains. Obviously, you know, he wants his own spinoff movie. But anyway, if he's listening to the show right now, what will he be hearing about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're going to do some house cleaning since we've been off for 2 weeks. Actually, I've been off for 2 weeks. Michael actually never stops arguing, even when the microphone is off and I'm not there to argue back. But yes,
hey,
we're going to play catch up a little bit. You see, he's arguing now. I'm basically telling you what Michael does, and he's arguing about it. We're going to play catch up, including 2 weeks of box office and why China banned Justin Bieber for being a bad influence. Then during our book filter segment, Michael will talk about his pick from last week because it's one of the best books of the year and he doesn't want it to fall through the cracks. Just don't hold your breath waiting for Putin's Russia to turn it into a feature film. On Inside Baseball, we'll discuss a story that's been percolating about The Walking Dead and a fight over how much money the billion-dollar hit TV series should have made, not how much is being reported. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office from around the world. We've got a link to Comscore in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you name it. Big showdown this week at the box office, and no, we're not talking about the showdown in North America between Dunkirk and the Emoji Movie, which thankfully Dunkirk won. We're talking about the showdown in China between a big popular film called Wolf Warrior 2 and a government-approved propaganda effort called The Founding of an Army. Yes, it wasn't even close in this case, whereas Dunkirk and Emoji was close. The number one movie around the world, because that's where we look at the worldwide box office, it's Wolf Warrior 2, $125 million on the weekend. I think it opened on Wednesday, or certainly Thursday, because its total is $142 million. That's for a movie that cost reportedly $30 million to make. It's a sequel, of course, to Wolf Warrior 1. This movie grossed more in its opening 3 or 4 days than the original movie grossed in its entire run. That movie made about $90 million total. This one opened to $142 million in five territories. That's a huge win for the movie, which is co-written, directed, produced, and starring former martial artist Wu Jing, a.k.a. Jackie Wu. He's a big star now, obviously, in China. And it faced down that movie, which is a government film about, you know, the founding of the Chinese army. That was directed by a Hong Kong director named Andrew Lau, an actor turned director. That had the stamp of government approval on it. They won't even allow criticism of the movie online. No Rotten Tomatoes for this movie. You can't post negative reviews or anything. Don't talk about it. Just go see it. It's your patriotic duty to see The Founding of an Army. That movie grossed $24 million on its opening weekend. It's at just under $30 million. Which may be fine, we don't know the budget, but dear God, that's not even close to the $140 million of Wolf Warrior 2. So that is our number one movie around the world. It's about a government special ops agent who's also a brilliant sniper and marksman. And he's in the second movie, he's moved to Africa. He just wants to be left alone and be peaceful and quiet and tune with nature. But bad guys start targeting civilians around him and he has to go back into action. So that's the plot of Wolf Warrior 2. It's open in North America, too, on a couple screens. It didn't do great. But again, they said, hey, we want to let people have a chance to see it rather than just having to turn to counterfeiting.
Well, and there are expat communities of Chinese here in the United States, in San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, and other cities, where there are, you know, circuits that will play it, especially CGV.
Oh, of course. And you don't need to go to specialized circuits anymore to see a movie like this. It's probably playing in Times Square.
Oh, that's true, too. Yeah.
You know, that's the really amazing thing. You're not having to go to some out-of-the-way place that only, you know, people from that community are aware of. Now they play in, you know, you got 24 screens, you need to fill them up, and they're happy to play Wolf Warrior 2.
So just as an example here in Los Angeles, It is playing at the AMC Burbank Town Center 8. The AMC Atlantic Times Square. I don't know where that is to be. Oh, that's in Times Square, isn't it?
It would be, yes.
So this is literally not just in Los Angeles. It's all over the country. It's also playing at the AMC Santa Anita 16. So two of the three theaters that it is playing in the United States are in Los Angeles. And I will tell you, what is the common denominator there? If you really start
thinking. Asian population.
Well, okay, yes, but think about the theater chain that is showing that movie.
Wanda's.
Well, no, it's AMC. We'll get to
Wanda.
That. We'll get to that in a moment.
Right. Wolf Warrior 2 is playing on 53 screens in North America, so more than a handful, so that's pretty good. At number two around the world is Dunkirk, the Christopher Nolan film that opened up last weekend to great reviews and very strong box office. It made $73 million on the weekend, beating out the poorly reviewed Emoji movie in North America. It has made $234 million. I've seen it twice in IMAX, 70mm. I have done that. Very good movie. Certainly, it will be on my best of the year list and the best Hollywood film in quite a long while.
Now, did you see it on LIMAX or IMAX?
Are you kidding me?
Okay, never mind.
I saw it in IMAX 70mm in Birmingham, Alabama, which was a mistake because it turned out to be a dome theater. Oh. It was an actual dome. I was like, no, I didn't realize. I'm like, oh my God, we have a genuine IMAX 70mm showing here in Birmingham. That's awesome. It's a dome. But I still really liked the movie. And then I went to Nashville, Tennessee and saw it there with friends. And I saw that in proper IMAX with the slightly curved, but basically flat screen. And, it's amazing. It was shot in IMAX. The detail is unbelievable. You feel like you can reach out and touch the mask on the pilot and the uniforms of the soldiers. And I thought the movie was really well made. By far my favorite Christopher Nolan film. The first movie of his I've actually really liked.
Now, just to backtrack a bit, the AMC Atlantic Times Square 14 is in Monterey Park, one of the largest Chinese populations outside of, in the United States, for sure.
That makes sense.
In Los Angeles. So those three were in Los Angeles, you're right. So
there you go. And number three is Despicable Me 3, another $43 million. That's at $820 million worldwide. And number four, Spider-Man Homecoming, $33 million on the weekend, $633 million worldwide. And number five, this summer has been a story, or actually the whole year, of movies being pretty well reviewed or embraced by audiences and making money. And the movies that are crappy have often not made as much money. So that's been a really good trend this year. If that's what the effect of Rotten Tomatoes or instant word of mouth is, then I'm all for it. Here's one of the counterexamples. It's War for the Planet of the Apes. It got pretty good reviews. A nice solid ending to the franchise. I liked it. I didn't love it, but I think the trilogy as a whole is pretty solid. This movie made $30 million on the weekend. It's at $225 million worldwide. It's pretty wide now. It's in 62 territories, and it cost $150 million to make. It's going to be hard for them to get to $450 million, but we'll see where it ends up.
Well, look at Despicable Me 3. That was not widely reviewed positively, you know.
No, it wasn't. It's not. That's not every movie. It was not. That's the other counterexample, a movie that was not wildly well reviewed, but still did make a lot of money. Absolutely. You're quite right. And then there's another counterexample, if we want to keep going countering, the Emoji movie. Very viciously poor reviews, but it was so cheap, about $50 million, that its opening weekend of $25 million from just North America means this movie is going to be just fine when all is said and done. And number seven is that propaganda film in China, The Founding of an Army, that made $30 million since it opened on Wednesday, I think. And number eight is Battleship Island, yet another Korean film that won't play well in Japan. This one is, again, about Korean prisoners trying to break out of a forced labor camp called Hashima in 1945. It's sort of The Great Escape, but with coal and in Japan. This island is very famous. The director said, "I'm sorry, Japan, I'm not trying to foster anti-Japanese sentiment, but the shape of the island really looks like a battleship. It's a real place when you look at it from the sky." And that just intrigued him so much. That's why he decided to tell the story of what happened on this island. It's a world preservation site, though many countries fought that until Japan agreed that if it became a world preservation site, they would acknowledge the forced labor that took place on that island for decades. So it's an interesting concept. It is cool to see the real island from the air. It does look like that. And it grossed its budget on opening weekend. It cost about $21 million to make, and it made $22 million in Korea. At number nine is Girls Trip, another big hit. And the reviews were mixed, I think, but they were pretty polite. But it's making a lot of money. The best reviewed R-rated comedy of the year, or the best grossing R-rated comedy of the year. $22 million on the weekend, $67 million so far, and it only cost $20 million to make, so it's already a hit. At number 10 is Atomic Blonde, the Charlize Theron produced and starring action film set during the Cold War and co-starring James McAvoy. Atomic Blonde is based on a comic book. It grossed $21 million on its opening weekend. It's pretty modestly budgeted, so that looks like another winner.
And it's opening, I guess it opened in the U.S., but limited? Is that the idea?
No, it's wide in the U.S. It's okay. In 12 territories. I mean, it made $18 million in North America, so that's where it made most of its money.
Okay, so sorry. I'm looking at wrong numbers.
It's not like on five screens or anything like that.
Okay.
At number 11, a movie that got poor reviews and has done very poorly, it's Luc Besson's Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Don't ask me why, but I saw it.
Oh my God, why?
My friend wanted to see it, and I was all for a bad movie. I can't recommend it as a good bad movie, but it was very bad, and I did enjoy how bad it was. So, you know, there you go. $20 million this weekend, $52 million worldwide, but it's only in 14 territories. And here's the fact. Luc Besson is a much bigger star and draw in most of the world than he is in North America. That's his weakest big market. Explain to me why they opened up in North America first so you could get the bad news out of the way. I mean, to me, that makes no sense. Why not open where he's strong and then open later in North America with actually a good track record behind you? I don't think it would have made any difference. Probably something to do with scheduling and calendars, but it's opened here and in 14 territories total, and it's not doing well. It's going to be very hard for them to make back their money. But again, he's a much bigger draw in other parts of the world. So that $180 million is looking very scary. The people behind it say they've sold off most of the movie. It's already fine thanks to pre-sales. Yeah. We'll believe it when we see it. When a movie does this poorly, it's really hard to make your money back.
Well, yeah. And that's like saying, don't worry. We stiffed somebody else. I mean, somebody's getting stiffed.
Talking the stock of Eurocorps, I mean, that's a valid point to make, isn't it?
Well, that's what they're trying to pretend, yes. But at the end of the day, you still have people losing money. Somebody's losing money on this movie, and they're not going to be happy about it.
Right, but they're saying don't short our stock.
Right. Yeah, well, whatever. Yeah. I mean, I think...
All right, and number 12 is Baby Driver, another hit with good reviews. $12 million on the weekend, $140 million worldwide. That's five times its estimated budget. So that's really another solid success story. And again, Transformers The Last Night, terrible reviews. $10 million on the weekend, $568 million worldwide, but that ain't a patch on the $220 million it cost to make, and then there's marketing. So this movie really fell hard from the previous ones. It's not done yet, but boy, this is not looking good.
No, and now they're doing a spinoff with Haley Steinfeld, so the Bumblebee spinoff.
Really, they really want to rethink that, don't they?
Well, they're not. They're going into production already. It's just so ludicrous.
The Bumblebee is already a greenlit and it's already happening?
Yes, it's just there's no reason for it and they're doing it anyway. Think about it. It's Paramount. They need movies. They have nothing. So they need to do something.
But Bumblebee is not the answer.
I agree. I think they'll
sometimes
find that out themselves.
Sitting at home is a smarter thing to do.
Yes.
At number 14, Cars 3, the third Cars film. The third Cars film to get not very good reviews. The third Cars film to make okay box office. And the third Cars film, perhaps, to goose a ton of merchandise.
That's
$9 million on the weekend, $270 million worldwide. And number 15, a movie that's playing right downtown here in Birmingham, Alabama, Mubarak Khan, a Bollywood romantic comedy about twin brothers who are in love with women. Amil Kapoor is not the guy playing twins, but he is the scene stealer of this movie, which grossed $4.4 million on its opening weekend, including six territories, including, of course, Birmingham, Alabama. $3 million budget for this movie. It didn't get very good reviews from the Indian press, as far as I can tell. And but it's going to be okay commercially. And number 16 is The Big Sick. It's at $32 million worldwide and counting. Scrolling down, looking for some good news or a new movie. No, that's about it. The Mummy is really underperforming. It made $4 million on the weekend. That's at $400 million worldwide. They claim a budget of $125 million, but we don't buy it. Clearly not a great launch to that franchise, though maybe they won't lose their shirt. And same thing with Pirates of the Caribbean, not doing well, but it's at $775 million worldwide. It's kind of hard to lose money when you make $775 million worldwide, but they're going to do their damnedest.
Well, and again, this is a movie and a franchise that gooses a ton of merchandise at the theme parks and elsewhere for Disney.
Yes, though they really want to give this one a rest.
Yes, I think everybody will tell you that. I mean, I think even before this movie came out, it was like, ugh, another one.
Well, you know, and you talked about AMC and how they are owned a subsidiary, if that's the proper term, for Wanda, the
okay.
Chinese company.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because you always say Wanda. Every time I say AMC, you say Wanda, it's Wanda. Okay, technically, and I've always said, well, Wanda bought them. They bought the largest share of AMC. And these are technicalities. Okay, these are all monetary and you know, stock technicalities. They wanted to be very clear. AMC, the movie theater chain in North America, and of course now they're overseas in Odeon and the Nordic Cinema Group, they are their own company, traded on the New York Stock Exchange. They have their own stock price. They have their own money. All of these issues that are happening to Wanda,
Well, they're under government pressure to not keep investing tons of money overseas. And people have said, well, gee, AMC has some deals. Is that going to affect their ability to operate properly and finish these deals? And AMC said,
not at all. We are our own company. We have our own money. There's no such thing as backstop financing. Wanda does not finance us. We do it with our own money, our own debt, period. We bought Carmike with our own money. We bought Odeon with our own money. Wanda did not give us money to do that. We took the debt on ourselves. Daily and Wanda is our largest shareholder. They own, a majority of the shares. However, we are our own company. And they really wanted to make that very clear, because what's going on in China right now, and Michael, you started us off actually talking about two Chinese films, right? One was Wolf Warrior 2. Well, and you said, wow, you know, it made so much more money. Well, think about the difference between 2015 and 2017, the number of additional movie theater screens in China. Okay, there may be mm-hmm. twice as many theater screens
wow.
in China as there were in 2015. If not, there's at least, you know, 20 to 30% more. So there's...
Well, that's a lot less than 100% more.
Well, true. But
but again, that's why the doors are opening wide for Hollywood product. They've got a lot of screens to fill.
Right. And so what is happening now? And oh, by the way, right now, there are no Hollywood films being opened in China.
There's a 6-week summer blackout period.
Right. So it's a little bit easier. However, you also mentioned Founding of an Army. And this was the propaganda film in mm-hmm. which, you know, you can't write a bad review about the film, because if you do, then all of a sudden your newspaper somehow gets shut down, right?
Well, no, that's not what I said. They have a site where people can post comments, but they're not allowing those comments to be made of any nature, not even to praise it. They're just like, no comments, just go see the film.
Right. So, you know, we kind of covered a couple weeks ago how Wanda was, they're getting out of the theme park business. They're going to, you know, all these rumors that you know, banks had said, oh, well, you should short them or sell their bonds or not buy their bonds because, you know, they're over leveraged. They have too much debt. Where are they getting all this money from? Well, sure enough, it's slowly coming out that it is Xi Jinping and his administration. He is the Chinese president that is turning to companies such as Wanda. They're not the only one, but they are the largest company in the entertainment space doing all of these deals overseas. And they're basically saying, Wanda, that's it. No more. You're done. Okay. You have to be loyal to the Chinese market, loyal to the Chinese government. You operate at our pleasure, so to speak. And so all of a sudden, Wanda's boss, of course, now I'm going to...
We covered this 2 weeks ago.
Well, no.
That the government was saying no more money for you to do overseas transactions. We covered that.
Well, we didn't cover that. It's that we
did.
What we covered was the questioning of it and the rumor that all of these banks were looking into Wand, and of course, most
and
of
then
them
we
government
and
owned.
Then we covered the fact that we had found out it wasn't just rumor, that the government had said you're not allowed to invest money overseas right now. Stop it, everybody, stop it. We're putting the brakes on that.
Well, no, that actually, that was all rumored. Now it's true. And if you look at what's going on in China, okay, forget about the fact that, you know, we're talking about Wanda and we're talking about the Chinese, you know, cinema space. But if you look at what's going on in China, Xi Jinping is up
for a slowdown in the economy.
Well, and they are up for renewal. You know, his presidency, if you will, is up for renewal. And he had a five-year term. Congress is probably going to put him in for another five-year term. And there's some question about whether he wants a third five-year term, which technically is not possible. So he's basically getting his base around him and saying, look, you all have to be loyal to me. No more of this, these outside forces. I want all inside forces. He's taking, you know, a little bit of a stronger arm with the military. And that's part of this. And of course, the Wanda boss, the head of Wanda, is saying, okay.
Well, I'm not sure why we're discussing party politics. Yes. He's the leader of the country. It's a one-party system. He wants to maintain power. They have an economy that's slowing down. They don't want money to keep flowing out overseas. They want to try and make sure their economy gets more stable. And they're saying pause on international expansion.
Right. At a time when, you know, as you say, the politics is kind of churning a little bit.
And right.
And so going back to Wanda, they're going to be investing in China. AMC is separate. They're investing in the United States, and they wanted to make clear that they are their own company.
That's right. And I heard them loud and clear. They said, we are our own company. Just please believe us. Shay, shay, and goodbye. I mean, thank you. Thank you and goodbye.
Well, I mean, they went point by point about, you know, intercompany transactions between.
I made a joke.
Okay, I know. But they, okay. You know,
well,
when you look
like
at the balance sheet. I don't know how many people understand Mandarin to know that the Shay Shay part was the joke.
Uh-huh. Well, it's no joke for Justin Bieber, who got banned from China. And unlike a lot of pop stars who get banned from China because they speak out on Tibet or human rights abuses in China or standing up for certain artists or political groups or young people in Hong Kong protesting with the Umbrella Movement, Justin Bieber got banned because he's a bad boy.
Yeah, I guess I guess he's just a bad influence, right? He makes the girls scream, and so therefore they said no more. You know, you're throwing eggs at people's cars, you're getting tattoos, you're lots of trouble, and every time we read about you, it's all about, you know, how you're getting into trouble. That's it. We don't want you in our country.
He also made bad news for canceling the last few dates on his tour, apparently because he was just burned out. These were 14 final shows. Added to this to the tour. They had just gone on sale, and then he just, you know what, I'm done, and they yanked them out. So you know, you feel bad when people plan 6 months or a year in advance to go see a concert, and I'm sure anybody who bought those tickets is bummed, but this feels a little different, and artists always have to learn to like say no. Like, people will just keep you on that treadmill. He's been in 150 shows in 40 countries on 6 continents over the last year and a half. So, you know, he should have said no before they scheduled the dates and put tickets on sale. But as far as I'm concerned, I don't know anything about it. Like, whatever, but good for him, because you have to, like, say no, or they will just keep you going until you are run down to nothing. So that may be one of the smarter things he's done in a while, because I'm assuming he's burned out and he needs a break, and he's the only one who can make that happen.
Now, let me ask you something. I know, you know, that was, we're talking about China, and of course, he's not the first person to ever be banned from China. The first musician, Bob Dylan, was banned recently for all of his stuff back in the 60s. So, you know, Bjork was banned back in 2008 for talking about the Dalai Lama.
But usually for political reasons.
Yeah, it's usually for political reasons. But I wanted to go back to whether you saw Dunkirk in 3D. In IMAX, or whether you just...
3D, I don't even know if they showed it in 3D. I don't believe they did.
Yeah, no, that's right. They didn't.
No, because it's not a 3D movie. They showed it in IMAX 2D, 70 millimeter. There were some IMAX screens, of course, or LIMAX, whatever, but I saw it in 70 millimeter on an IMAX screen, and it looked terrific, and that's why I went back twice.
You know, Greg Foster, the CEO of IMAX, he actually said, quote, "It's worth noting Dunkirk was showing exclusively in 2D, which consumers have shown a strong preference for. We're looking
and he means not in that movie. He means in general.
Yes. He says, we're looking forward to playing fewer 3D versions of films and more 2D versions. And this was during an earnings call. And I saw that headline, IMAX is moving away from 3D. And I just thought, oh, Michael has got to be jumping up and down in his seat right now.
I'm happy to see a movie in IMAX when it's shot in IMAX like Dunkirk. Anyone who goes to see a movie in IMAX that wasn't shot substantially in IMAX or has some reason to be shown in IMAX and the director wants you to see that way, you're wasting your money. If you make a movie in 3D and it's really good and people say that's the way to see it, I'm happy to see it in 3D. For most movies, IMAX is not necessary. For most movies, 3D is not necessary. It's just a way of tacking on expenses. But when they do it well and well done, I'll go see Avatar 2 in 3D, I'm sure. And I was thrilled to see this movie in IMAX because it was shot in IMAX and it looked great. And that's the way the director wanted you to see it. So, you know, I'm not opposed to any technology. Use it well, do it creatively. Tell me it's worth the expense. I'm happy to pay.
You know, I was listening to reviews of The Valerian on some radio show, and the critic said, well, in Valerian, and it's in 3D, although I don't know why you'd see it in 3D.
Well, it wasn't shot, it wasn't made for 3D.
Right.
You know, the way they're kind of showing it in 3D, but again, it wasn't made for that purpose, yeah.
He just kind of threw it out there like, I don't know why you'd see this movie in the first place, but certainly don't bother seeing it in 3D.
Oh, well. But where do you turn for reviews for books?
Well, I would say every week, and sometimes several times a week, because I need to look something up, so I use it as a reference site, I go to bookfilter.com. Bookfilter is a book lover's best friend, and every week, Michael, you pick out a few books just for us to tell the industry what they should be reading or maybe even looking at to turn into a movie or a television show. What do you have for us this week?
Well, I don't quite have that this week. This week there's a Viking saga. And who doesn't like a good Viking saga? It's called The Half-Drowned King by Liana Hartsoiker. And other than the names, which get a little difficult to pronounce, it's a very fun adventure tale about Vikings. I'm really enjoying the book. I'm almost three quarters of the way done. But I wanted to go back to last week, the week we had off. The book that came out that week is one of the best books of the year. It's a history book, a nonfiction book, an oral history, actually, about World War II. As seen from the perspective of Soviet women. And it's called The Unwomanly Face of War by Svetlana Alexievich. She won the Nobel Prize for Literature a few years ago. That was kind of controversial. She was the first journalist to win the Nobel Prize. They've really been pushing the boundaries of what is literature. Is music literature, songs? Yes, it is. And Bob Dylan is a Nobel laureate. Is journalism literature? It can be. And this is a great example of that. And it was translated into English by our superstar Russian translators, Richard Prevere and Larissa Volokonsky, because if you're going to translate something into English from Russian, you want them to do it.
As a matter of fact, we talked about them when I was talking about, which translation of Anna Karenina should I read? You know, which translation of Tolstoy should I read? And you just like off the top of your head without any preparation mentioned their names. And I was like, how do you even know that?
Well, of course. Oprah loved them. Everybody loves them. So this book is really a masterpiece. It's just great. It's an oral history, talking to women about serving in the war. The best comparison I can make, and it's a heady one, is the film documentary Shoah by Claude Lanzmann. That obviously dealt with the horror of the Holocaust. This deals with the tribulations of World War, of course, and a lot of miserable stuff. It's not quite on that level of atrocity, but it is the same approach where you're talking to people, eyewitnesses, about what they did. It's not about, you know, grand scale or philosophical questions. It's like, how did you eat? How did you sleep? What did you do with your hair? What about when you had a period? Because we're talking about women. How did you get to the front? What happened when you were there? And these women are not all nurses. You know, the women served in the infantry. They served as snipers. They served as pilots. They were tank gunners. They were overseeing men. They were also nurses and making food and doing laundry. They did everything, and they demanded to be at the front. I mean, story after story of girls who were 16 or 17 demanding, begging, pleading to go to the front. And it just begins sort of humorously and interestingly with the quotidian details of getting to the front. And it moves all the way through the war. And by the end, you've dealt with Stalinism and the purges and the mass starvation and people becoming disillusioned with communism, people regaining their faith. It's just a remarkable, remarkable book. It's really entertaining, really fun. It's upsetting. I mean, you know, there's unbelievable stories of courage and horror, but it's a really great book. I just wouldn't wait for it to be turned into a movie anytime soon by Putin, because it's not exactly aggrandizing to Russia.
Well, now, let me ask you this.
So I beg your pardon. I should say it is aggrandizing to the Russian people who bled and actually won the war as much as anyone else. The tens of millions of Russians who died fighting the Nazis and the fascists. I won the war as much as anyone. Far more people in Russia in the Soviet Union died than in America or anywhere else in the world as far as combatants. And they're the reason, you know, we won the war as much as anyone. So it does aggrandize them and their immense war effort.
Well, do you think the unwomanly face of war next year will be on the Man Booker long list?
Because I'm certain it won't be, because A, it's nonfiction, and B, it came out in 1988. This is its first translation into English. Perhaps it's available for some translation prize down the road, but I'm pretty sure it's not up for the Booker.
Ah, okay. Well, the Man Booker Prize for Fiction is open to writers of now any nationality who write in English and then get published in Britain. American authors were first eligible in 2014. And this year's list actually includes a whole bunch of Americans. I think, at least four, right?
Yeah, I think so.
So we have, and some books, by the way, that you have mentioned on this very show. And one of them is Lincoln in the Bardo, George Saunders' first full-length novel. Everybody goes to great length, no pun intended, to mention that it's his first full-length novel. The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead, which also, by the way, won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. Can it do, is there like, you know, the EGOT, the Emmy, Grammy?
Exactly.
Is there something like that in the book world?
There's about to be, I guess.
Yeah. Now, here's a question, because I've heard mixed reviews of this next book, The God of Small Things. This is...
That's her
first book. Sorry.
Arun Dadi Roy's debut novel. Her new book is called The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, and it did get mixed reviews, but it's she's got a big fan base, and it's doing well commercially, and obviously it has some ardent supporters.
And have you read the book?
I have not. That's a safe answer. But with 100,000 books coming out from major publishers, you can almost always say no.
And what did you think of this year's Man Booker long list? Are we like, huh?
Well, there's books I've read and loved, obviously, like both Lincoln and the Bardo and The Underground Railroad. Other books I want to read because they're on the list. And that's the main purpose for me. When I see the list, I say, oh, I've been thinking of that book, and now here's another reason to go read it. In general, I am feeling a little bit of, did they make a mistake expanding to North America? Because it just feels a little familiar when you're seeing three or four or five books that have already won lots of awards. It's kind of like becomes Oscar season where, you know, you have Cannes and you have all these film festivals. You feel like, oh, you know, it gets to be a little repetitive. So I don't know. We'll have to wait 10 years to see how we feel about it. But perhaps they've made themselves a little less special by opening it up to all English language novels. But you know what? They're great books. They deserve the attention.
Okay. Well, I mean, I look forward to seeing who wins. I don't think I'll be able to read certainly not all of these novels, though some I do want to catch up with, like Lincoln and the Bardo and The Underground Railroad. But that wraps up our book filter section for this week and moves us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines and entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. We have some catching up to do, so our first story, Woody Allen. Woody Allen's new film, Wonder Wheel, will be the closing night offering for the New York Film Festival. No big surprise there. Woody and New York just go together. Like, what? Peanut butter and jelly, I guess. What is news here is the fact that the studio backing the film is Amazon, okay? That's actually, in a way, not news, because Amazon has been backing Allen. But here's the thing. Amazon is now getting into film distribution. Instead of farming out their movies one by one to, like, Roadside Attractions and Lionsgate, Amazon is going to actually start distributing the films themselves. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. In other words, Paramount, Disney, Warner Brothers, meet the new studio on the block.
Correct. Yes. And we all knew, everybody who works in this space knew, wow, Amazon is either going to do one of two things, and we think they're going to do the latter. Since they have so much darn money, they can continue to work with all of these other, you know, service entities, like a Roadside Attractions, like a Lionsgate. I'm trying to think of somebody else, that like an STX Entertainment, basically farming out their movies, you know, on a per movie basis to these entities, who will then take a cut of usually around 15% for distributing the film for Amazon. or they can eventually learn how to do it themselves by watching all of these different entities and how they do it, and then maybe even hiring away somebody from one of those service companies, service distributors like a Roadside. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're taking the second route. They're going to be distributing the films themselves now that they've learned how.
Well, since Amazon is delivering packages to your door and they've got shipping containers coming from overseas and drones coming to your doorstep, you can think, yes, of course, they're going to want to do everything themselves because eventually they think they can make more money that way.
Right. Everybody thought that this was going to happen. It's no big deal. Kind of like when we mentioned Quincy Jones suing Michael Jackson, we said, well, of course, he's going to get
Michael Jackson, the Michael Jackson estate.
Well, yes. But the Michael Jackson estate, we all said, hey, you know what? We kind of think we know how it's going to end. And Quincy Jones was victorious in court. The estate of Michael Jackson had conceded. He was owed about $400,000 in royalties due to an accounting error. Just a simple...
I love an accounting error like that, wouldn't you?
Oh, is that where the comma goes? Okay, yeah. But Jones said he was due millions, actually. A jury agreed with Jones and gave him $9.4 million in unpaid monies. Jones declared victory, and the other side's attorneys basically said he was taking food and clothes, but food out of the mouths of Michael Jackson's children. It wasn't the $30 million Jones asked for, by the way, but it was a lot of money. Big deal or big whoop.
I guess you could say Quincy Jones filed a lawsuit and the Michael Jackson estate couldn't beat it.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. Did I do that? It's like a Sperling joke. He so far, the interesting detail here, it's not a case that's important because it doesn't have any sort of overarching importance. It doesn't influence other cases. The only interesting detail is that before this award, he had already received about $18 million in royalties since Michael Jackson's death. So that means $27 million as a producer and arranger and guy involved in that album he received since Michael Jackson's death. That's how much money they've been making in that burst of attention after he died.
Well,
wow.
And to give you some sense, if that album were released today and were as big a hit, meaning, you know, as big an influence.
It couldn't be. Yeah.
Yeah. He would earn about $27.
Oh, you mean if it was just streaming a lot? Yeah,
exactly. Speaking of streaming, the music streaming service Pandora is getting out from down under. Yes, they're abandoning the Australian and New Zealand markets, leaving some 5 million registered users adrift. They launched in, you know, New Zealand and Australia in 2012, and they say goodbye like right now or today. Actually, yeah, no, like right now, today, July 31st is their last day. It's apparently a cost-cutting measure with the audience there not big enough to justify the expense of operating across the territory. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's just a big confusion for me. I just don't understand this. What expenses are there once you've launched?
Well, there's licensing. You have to license the music for that territory. So
yeah.
at the very
5
least,
5 million people is not enough to make money on it?
And there's an infrastructure cost of actually having all the servers and the technology to serve that that territory. So there is that
as
well.
That would be, but they've already sunk that cost. Or,
right.
they're renting it, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's more like the latter, renting. And then, of course, there's the marketing and the, you know, you basically have to have an operation there. And much like, you know, Amazon will probably spend a minimum of $15 million just to have staffing and offices to distribute their movies, okay, which is why a lot of, you know, production companies just go the service distribution route. They don't want to spend the $15 million.
But Australia is 25 million people. I don't know how many are in New Zealand, but Australia is 25 million people, and then there's plus New Zealand. They've got 5 million users. That's like 20% of the entire population. How many did they expect to get? How could that not be profitable for them? I mean, New Zealand has four, so it's 30 million people in those two countries, and they have 5 million of them. One out of every six people subscribes to Pandora, and they can't make money on that?
Well, it also might. Well, there's also a couple of things to keep in mind, okay? And I know some of our listeners are from New Zealand, are from Australia, and I'm sure they will point out that bandwidth in Australia, especially, costs a lot of money. So we take it for granted that we can get, you know, cable bandwidth at 250 megabit per second and it's not a problem, or even a gigabit per second and it's, you know, may cost a little more, but we can get it. We can actually get it. Whereas in Australia, it's really difficult to get that kind of bandwidth without paying a fortune. And oh, by the way, they have data caps, some serious data caps that are very, very low. So there's, you know, they might have one out of every six people. That might be the maximum number of people they can get based on the limits of bandwidth and the infrastructure in Australia. They also might not be doing very well in selling advertising there. And that might be another reason.
Does that affect other companies trying to do business in Australia and New Zealand?
Oh, yes, it does. Hello, Netflix. Yes, it absolutely does.
And so, are there any people who don't go into Australia and New Zealand because of these restrictions? They just say it's not worth our trouble, and they know that in advance.
Netflix for a while didn't, because they knew that it was a problem, and then eventually they just had to, which is why for years, you know, they kind of looked at they looked at who was logging in and where those IP addresses were at Netflix, and they said, "Gee, we have a lot of Australian and New Zealand." Customers, when it reaches a certain point, we'll actually go in and do it ourselves rather than have them use passwords from other people's, you know, from U.S. accounts and go through a proxy server, which is what was happening.
I was trying to lead you right into SiriusXM because you told me before the show they're not even in that market. And this is probably a reason why.
Well, SiriusXM, again, that's more satellite driven. So they are a satellite.
It's completely satellite driven.
Yeah, exactly. So, and, you know, they have licenses for the United States, for North America, and that's where they're going to keep them. So why
are they not in that market if you linked it to this?
Oh, well, here's the thing. SiriusXM wanted to buy Pandora. They bought a, you know, 19% of Pandora a couple weeks ago. And so they're basically saying, hey, we don't work in that territory. You don't have to worry about that territory anymore. We're going to buy you for this territory, and that's what we're interested in.
Ah, now I get you.
Yeah. Eventually, maybe we'll expand. We can go back to Australia. That's effectively what they're saying. Now, speaking of going back, Broadway's The Great Comet has suddenly floundered in the wake of Josh Groban's departure in a lead role. Now, remember, Michael, you said, hey, this was lazy reporting. It didn't, they're not floundering. It was, you know, the lead. Remember
well,
that?
The grosses weekly are fine. They're above $900,000, and everyone says that has to be above their operating costs. So, but this is apparently linked to other issues they're claiming.
Okay. Well, first, the producers announced, okay, you're going to have to do this for me, Michael. How do you pronounce?
His nickname is Oak, the actor Oak. He's from Hamilton, Oak Onaodowan. Okay. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, but I did my best. He took over Pierre for just 9 weeks. That's a lead role. It was played by Josh Groban, and Oak took it over. He came from Hamilton, not a huge name, but certainly from the hottest, you know, cast in town. And he was one of the original cast members of Hamilton, a black actor taking over a role previously played by white men. So that was pretty notable.
Well, then the 9 week run with Oak in it was cut short by 3 weeks when producers announced actor Mandy Patinkin would take over the role for just 3 weeks until he had to start shooting his TV show Homeland again. Patinkin would unquestionably have boosted box office at a Groban-like level. The producers said Oak was graciously stepping aside and was welcome back anytime he wanted, except that he wasn't. Other actors denounced casting aside an actor playing the role for just 2.5 months. Then Oak himself said he was grateful for the chance to do the role, but a little hurt that he was pushed out and no, he wouldn't be returning ever. Then Mandy Patinkin said he had no idea Oak wasn't on board with this and refused to step into the role after all. Patinkin said the producers misled...
Patinkin. I'm sorry. Mandy Patinkin. He keeps saying it wrong.
Oh, what do I say Patinkin?
You're saying Patinkin. I don't know what that is. Mandy Patinkin.
Okay. Well, you know, I've always called him Mandy Patinkin, but and he's never...
That's why he never returns your call.
And that's true. But Mandy Patinkin said the producers misled him, basically. And if your head is hurting after all of this, congratulations. I need some aspirin. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, this is the thing. The producers now are trying to do damage control. Let's say, no, you don't understand. This show is going to close. That since Josh Groban left, advanced ticket sales have collapsed, completely collapsed. And we're just trying to save the show. And you're yelling at us, but no, we're just trying to save the show. The fact is they misled or didn't speak clearly to Oak. They misled or didn't speak clearly to Mandy Patinkin. And there's no way on God's green earth, 3 weeks of performances from Mandy Patinkin, when they're going to have to pay Oak his contract anyway, rehearse Mandy Patinkin to get him in the show and advertise him in the show and have him there for just 3 weeks, is going to rescue anything or anyone. So it's all a lie. Well, I don't know about advanced ticket sales collapsing. That may be true. I'd like you to open your books and then I could know it for sure. But all I can see is ticket grosses are above your operating cost. There's no way on God's green earth Mandy Patinkin was going to make a difference from 24 performances, especially when you got to pay the guy he's replacing anyway, because they don't get to just not pay him.
Right. It's a contract role. Yeah.
Right. So it's just ridiculous. They're just trying to cover their asses. And the show may be collapsing. Maybe advanced ticket sales have collapsed. I don't know. But they also said, you know, they threw pop star Ingrid Michaelson into the show. She plays a secondary role. She has basically one song. And they said, well, since she's left the show, advanced ticket sales have collapsed. Implying, of course, that a pop star with one hit like 8 years ago was a big draw on Broadway. I don't buy that either. You know, I'm sure she had some fans show up, but she did not goose the box office.
You know what they should be touting here? Here's what they should be touting. You need to see this show in this theater. Okay, I actually was thinking of going back to New York this year simply to see this show because, as you know, Michael, they retrofitted this theater to do this show. Okay, it can't be done in any other theater the way it's being done right now on Broadway.
Right. I'm sure when they tour it, they will somehow manage to do something like this because that's the vibe of the show. But, you know, 2 weeks ago, the last chance we had to look at the box office, 98% capacity and 86% of the total gross without Josh Groban in the lead role. That's with Oak performing. If they're losing money hand over, if they see 6 months from now there's no ticket sales, well, okay, maybe the show's not selling without Josh Groban in it. I don't see that effect yet. Advanced ticket sales are just that. They're advanced, so they've got a problem. But Mandy Patinkin for 3 weeks, it does not solve that problem. So if they need a big star, jerking this guy around, misleading him, misleading Mandy Patinkin, and then claiming, well, we're just trying to save our show. No, you screwed up in 8 different ways, and you're still screwing up, and now you've got a show that casts a lot of people of color. And like, how dare you get angry? We're trying to save our show. We cast... It's like, they're just insulting everybody every step of the way.
Do you think they're saying, oh my gosh, we're going to have to close as a way to get people like me who might want to, you know, have it on the 2C list? No, you better see it right away because it's going to close.
No, they're admitting that advanced ticket sales have plunged because they're trying to cover their ass for how they screwed up this transition.
Okay. Well, somebody that's doing a little bit better, at least one group here, is MSNBC. MSNBC has been the most watched 24-hour news channels a few times before, at least for a week at a time in terms of total audience. But now they've set a new benchmark. Recently, MSNBC was the most watched basic cable channel, period. So forget about news or, you know, whether it's AMC. They were the most watched basic cable channel. Take that, ESPN and History Channel and the rest of you. It's one more sign that Trump may be bad for the country, but he's good for 24-hour news channels. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? I mean, you know, it's good news for MSNBC. It's a long time coming, and it's just part of the general trend where they're all doing pretty damn well.
The consumer giant Procter & Gamble did a little experiment in June that might send shockwaves through the internet, not television. They cut $100 million in digital ads, and that's in 1 month, by the way. And guess what? They saw no effect in sales. Nothing. Zip. Nada. Yet. The company is reevaluating what digital presence they have and where. Like many, they suspect people actively ignore most online ads, and thus, those online ads aren't worth the money. Mind you, we're not talking ads on the New York Times and ESPN.com. We're talking digital ads that P&G suspected were mostly just getting traffic from bots and ripped off content and the like. So apparently bots don't do a lot of shopping for diapers. Go figure. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I've been talking with people for a while about how it seems like there's a lot of money that gets into digital ads and we don't know what the payoff is. This looks like a sober first step towards saying, are we being smart on how we spend our money? Where is it actually going? Do we want to be on this particular website? Because it's hard to track that because you just put money in a pile and it just gets spread out over a million different websites. A lot of them, some of them are not very useful. But here's the really killer thing. Google is in court. I saw this in the Washington Post. They're in court because they want to prove digital ads lead to sales. They really want to do that. And they're being sued by a consumer watchdog group because they came up with this approach to data mining. And they're using a mathematical formula to try and track people who see digital ads and then go buy stuff in brick and mortar stores. How did they do it? Well, first, they obtained the credit and debit records for 70% of all U.S. consumers.
Yes. Well, that was step one. That's
legal. Then they amortized it and anonymized it. And so we're not looking at individual. We're not watching Sperling Reich and seeing what ad he looked at and then where he goes shopping. It's all anonymized. But holy moly, that was the first thing they did. They got every single debit and credit record for 70% of American consumers. And this watchdog group is saying, hey, first of all, really? And B, there's no way to opt out of it that's easy and makes sense. And they're like, no, you can opt out. It's like this really opaque procedure on their website. So this is a big issue. Are digital ads making money? Are they? Yes. Are they helping drive sales? Maybe. Google wants to prove it, and they're tracking your credit card purchases to do so.
And what they're really looking at here to kind of, you know, hey, gee, John Deere lawnmower, you know, company, you advertised across a number of sites. You spent, let's say, $20 million advertising to consumers across, let's say, 3, 4, 5, 1,000 sites. Not everybody's going to buy a tractor online, let's face it. But let me ask you this. In the 6 months previously, before you started advertising, what were your sales? What were your sales this time last year before you were advertising? And what are your sales now? Since people aren't buying online, we're going to look at credit card records. We don't care who the people are. We just want to know, are these people, have your sales increased based on advertising? This is one of the factors we're taking into consideration. And I get what they're doing. It does seem a little creepy when you put it the way you did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can see why people are a little creeped out by it. But
absolutely.
The reality
is... It's anonymous. Yeah. The fact is they know everything you had for lunch in the last 3 years anyway.
Yeah. They could say, hey, you know, McDonald's is doing quite well. We can tell from all these credit card purchases. We don't know who's buying it, but we know a lot of people are. Now, Michael, everything old is new again. Nickelodeon found big success bringing old shows back to prime time with Nick at Night. They even launched an entire channel based on the idea called TV Land. Now Hulu is getting even geekier. They're recreating ABC's TGIF lineup of family-friendly sitcoms by making a massive deal for more than 800 episodes of that network shows, including, by the way, Full House, Family Matters, Step by Step, Hanging with Mr. Cooper, and Perfect Strangers. None of those shows are actually good, but they were big hits in their day. The shows debut on Hulu starting September 29th, while Netflix begins season 3 of Fuller House on September 22nd, 30 years to the date the original show premiered. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course. It's a smart way to do your purchasing. You know, why not do something iconic like that? I hope they do it again. I hope they get NBC's Thursday night lineup, the classic Cosby Show, Family Ties, Cheers, Taxi, and Hill Street Blues. Or they could do CBS's Saturday night lineup, MASH, All in the Family, Mary Tyler Moore, The Bob Newhart Show, and The Carol Burnett Show. Arguably the greatest lineup of TV shows of all time. You know, they're a great thing. You could recreate entire nights from like 50, 60 years ago. So, you know, you got to be clever. You got to be smart. You got old shows. You want to package them in a way that makes sense. TGIF is a really good way to go.
Now, I wonder what's going to happen to Full House on Netflix. Certainly they're you know, producing Fuller House, Netflix is. But
yeah.
Wouldn't you want Full House to remain so that you could watch both the older 30 years ago show and the newer one?
Well, it's on Hulu.
Right, but wouldn't Netflix want it to remain on their service as well?
I assume it's exclusive and that Hulu has it. I don't think Netflix has it anymore.
Well,
that's the whole point. They're launching it on Hulu.
Yeah, I guess we'll
find out. They have the right to Full House. It's theirs now. You can't have it on Nickelodeon and on, you know, CBS. I mean, it's, you know, they have the rights to Full House now.
Nah, it hurts my head. Dios mío. Actually, that's a good way to start our next story. Because the hit single Despacito is one of the rare songs mixing Spanish and English to top the U.S. charts. But that was just the start. It also topped the charts in 34 other countries. Now the infectious tune by Luis Fonsi, with an assist, by the way, from Daddy Yankee and Justin Bieber in a remix, is one of the biggest hits in the world. In fact, it's been streamed more than 4.6 billion times in just 6 months, making it the most streamed song of all time, passing Bieber's Sorry in the process. It's also the fourth most played video in YouTube history and gaining fast on number 3. I wonder what number 3 is. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. The streaming is where the action is. That's why I keep saying Billboard needs to change their charts and stop translating streaming into something else. Just deal with what it is. That's where people hear music. And you can see that in Amazon again comes up because they've become the third biggest subscription music service in the world. There's Spotify with 53 million, Apple with 28 million. These are paid subscribers. And then Amazon Music with 16 million. Now, if you pay for Amazon Prime, you get Amazon Music for free. You just have to start using it. So that's one reason they've been able to grow a lot. But you know what? They're people, they're listening to music, and Amazon is paying out royalties. So that's good in a way, even though it's digital pennies. That's good for songwriters and artists. And you know, they've got the Echo. You know, if you buy the Echo, guess what? You suddenly got a speaker sitting in your room ready to stream Amazon Music at you. So it just keeps building on itself. The Echo is so popular that every time somebody buys one and puts it in their kitchen, at some point they're going to say, hey, Siri, play Despacito.
Oh, now you look at what you just did. I can't guarantee you there are people who are listening to this show that will now have Siri playing Despacito. Well, but at least they'll know what it sounds like now, I guess.
Yes, all I can say is lo siento.
Now, I wonder, here's the thing, is Amazon Prime, because I have Amazon Prime, but I don't think I have Amazon Music because of that, do I?
Yes, you do, absolutely.
They better, I know that they originally mentioned that, but I kind of immediately forgot whether I had it or not, and nor did I care because I had Spotify. So if they really want to take over for Spotify and get me to stop paying Spotify and start using their service, Amazon better, you know, step up to the plate a little bit. Speaking of stepping up to the plate, where's Google in all of this? Google Play. They should actually have a piece of this action, and they don't.
They've done poorly with books and music.
Yes, unbelievable. You know who's not doing poorly, actually? HBO. However, the team behind HBO's Game of Thrones has their next project lined up, okay? A drama called Confederate, in which the South seceded and slavery still survives as an institution in the United States. They prominently included people of color in major producerial roles, such as Nichelle Trample Spellman. That still didn't cut it. People expressed outrage and annoyance over the concept. Why not make a show where white people are the slaves, they wondered. Roxane Gay wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying she shuddered at the thought of the show, given the team's track record on Game of Thrones, and while noting she should say white people can write about whatever they want, that's not how it feels. HBO said, you know there's not even a script yet, right? So could you hold off on attacking it? Nope. The person behind the hashtag OscarsSoWhite campaign launched a hashtag NoConfederate campaign asking people to tweet that message so HBO would know they have no interest in a show that explores slavery in any sense. Journalist Kim Masters wonders on her radio show if HBO will ever air the show, and is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I wanted to ignore it. I wish it was a big whoop. It's, you know, there's two things. One, yes, I heard the concept of the show and I rolled my eyes and thought, well, that's not very interesting. Not because there's anything wrong with the concept, but because it's so familiar. There are a ton of alternate history books and serious works of fiction about this idea in various ways. So the problem is not that they came up with this idea or are doing it, but like, why aren't they picking up on one of the many established works that have done it well? You know, and indeed, the Underground Railroad, which is not quite like this, but similar in dealing with slavery, that is being turned into an air series, I think, by HBO. The Sellout, Paul Beatty deals with slavery in modern times. Underground Airline, a best-selling book that deals with this very idea that there's slave states and there's still slavery in the United States after a great, you know. Yes, the idea bores me that they're doing it and doing an original concept. I'm not excited or interested in it, but the idea that other people are saying, how dare they? First of all, we're talking about three of the most acclaimed books of the year deal with slavery. What about Roots? What about the movie 12 Years a Slave? What about the WGN series Underground, which is about slavery? It's set historically, but that's, you know, overseen by white people. And that just got canceled and just devoted an entire episode to Harriet Tubman giving a speech. There's a lot of creative, interesting stuff you can do around slavery. And to, you know, what is the man in the high castle? What if the Nazis win World War II? What if the South won? What if slavery still existed? There's nothing outrageous or ridiculous about this. And to say that only black people can write about it is really limiting. Women can write about men. Men can write about women. I'm not excited to see this show, but the idea that people are shuddering at the thought of it, wake up and grow up, because there's a million books doing the same thing. There's a ton of movies and TV shows. This is art and creativity, and if you want to have freedom of art, why don't you wait to judge something until it actually exists?
Well, Adele is leaving her music publisher. That's big news. Sure, the eyes of fans might glaze over what sounds like news only an accountant could care about, but as Paul McCartney told Michael Jackson, there's a lot of money in music publishing. So Adele joins Bob Dylan, Neil Diamond, Rush, and others at CSAC. Why? She's not saying, but CSAC pitches itself as more focused and nimble than its two bigger rivals. They pay out money every month rather than quarterly, and they combine both performance and mechanical rights in one payment. If you understand what that means, My goodness. Okay, you're probably in the music business. And to get really geeky, ASCAP and BMI have a partnership to track music usage, and the courts have made a ruling that won't recognize fractional licenses. So if one artist writes for BMI and the other for CSAC, they're going to have to figure out who collects the royalties for everyone. Wasn't this story so much fun? And wasn't it great that like I decided to start doing a Paul McCartney, you know, impersonation halfway through when I should have started? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because that's a big get for CSAC. We'll have to see what the impact is down the road. You know, I'm sure other people will follow her lead and say, I mean, when my contract is up, maybe I'll jump to CSAC. And by the way, if you're wondering, when you hear performance, think live performance, yes, but also think of anyone playing your music, like on the radio or in a restaurant. Like if a restaurant plays music, that's a performance right issue. For mechanical, think of any copy of that music, like an LP or a CD, like a mechanical copy of the music, as opposed to just playing it or live or you know, over the air. So a mechanical, think LP or CD, and yes, digital copies used for streaming. So when you're streaming or looking to an LP or CD, that's mechanical. And when it's being performed, either over the air or by a person live in concert, that's a performance right.
So for instance, the band Pearl Jam has been ending their shows for, you know, at least 10 years now with a song, Baba O'Reilly, written by The Who. Okay.
They perform it. Yeah.
They perform it. Okay.
Right. So that's a performance issue. That's right. A performance, right?
Performance license. Right. Exactly. And they have to actually clear it. Sometimes, you know, for instance, you know, at Coachella or Bonnaroo or the Isle of Wight Festival, a musician will start playing a song, and guess what? They have to then go get clearance and clear that song.
They pay for it. They pay for it.
They have to pay for it. That's right. You just can't, like, you know, do a little snippet and say, well, no, fair use. You have to pay for it.
Right. So if Pearl Jam performs it in concert, that's a performance right issue. If they then release a live album on an LP or CD or even streaming, that would be a mechanical issue.
Correct. And all those compilations, you know, hits of the 90s, guess what? That's a mechanical issue as well.
Yep.
James Bond will return. That's the promise that often appeared at the end of films starring 007. The franchise to end all franchises. It's a promise kept with MGM and Eon Productions planting their flag and saying the 25th official film in the Ian Fleming series will open on November 8th, 2019. Now all they need is a star, a director, a script, a big star to sing the theme song, a villain, and wait, this just in, Daniel Craig will return to play Bond for the fifth time. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Of course, they're just naming a date. Who cares? Wonder Woman named a date. Who cares? There's going to be a Wonder Woman 2. Knock me over with a feather. And if they're looking for someone to do the theme song, I say Harry Styles.
Ooh, that could actually work, actually, for the James Bond, you mean?
Yep.
Yeah, actually, that could work. His solo album is quite good, actually.
Well, I think he's got the big, broad sweep that they're looking for, the vibe of his title song, Sign of the Times, and some other stuff. That's what made me think of him. And now he's a movie star, thanks to his role in Dunkirk.
And remember when everybody thought, oh, Daniel Craig, he's done. He's done. He says he's done because he told a British magazine, I'd rather break this glass and slash my wrist than play James Bond again.
And or take $20 million.
I'll do it. I'll do it. When do we start? I think those movies take so much energy and so much time that an actor is like, oh, I really don't want to do it again after four times. I just want to go on and do other things. But it pays a lot of money, as you mentioned.
Well, I think he also wanted to end on a high note, which he might have done there. We'll have to see how this one comes out.
Well, thank God for Sundays. Ryan Seacrest will return as the host of American Idol on ABC. The show will air two nights a week, including Sundays. So that's practically the only scenario in which Seacrest could host and still remain on his talk show live with Kelly and Ryan. Indeed, Ripa was thrilled to announce the news herself, but actually, it wouldn't happen unless she signed off. She had to say yes, so apparently she really is fine with it. Katy Perry is busy too. She'll be a judge on the new show, and as a warm-up, Perry will host and perform at the MTV Video Music Awards. She's just chained to the rhythm. Maybe Ryan will give her some pointers. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, this show just gets more and more expensive. Katy Perry got $25 million. Ryan Seacrest apparently gets $12 million and no executive producer credit, which surprises me. They're talking to people like Charlie Puth and Lionel Richie to be judges. Charlie Puth would be a really cool choice, I think. Though it all depends on how much of a judge they can be. You know, it depends how serious they can do and not feel mealy-mouthed. But, you know, he's a good name, a good get for young people. So, you know, I don't understand how it works. I guess he's there in LA and then he flies back Monday, then he flies back to LA Monday night, and then he flies. I mean, you know, it's, I don't understand how it works logistically if there's two nights a week in LA. But, you know, it's so expensive. How are they going to make any money? I don't get it.
Well, why don't they just do this? Why not just shoot the show in New York? Okay.
Well, I know, but they said, no, we have to shoot in LA. I don't know why that is.
Yeah,
they're in like 10 cities. So why they think LA is important? Nobody gives a damn that it's in that center in LA. It could be in New York.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not speaking as a New York booster. I'm like, nobody literally cares that it's shot in LA. Nobody. Yeah. So I don't know. It's a venue. Nobody cares. Just do it in New York.
Well, yes, I guess the whole idea of you're going to Hollywood, but you know what? The same thing. You're going to New York. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You've made
New York works too.
Yeah. You're basically giving the location the importance by saying you get to move on. So you literally could say you're going to Lexington, Kentucky.
You're going to Broadway. Oh, no, that sounds too theatrical. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, HBO again, okay? They confirmed they were hit by a cyber attack targeting the network's original programming. Episodes of the shows Ballers and Room 104 were leaked, okay? So Ballers and Room 104 were leaked. And this prompted a question, at least by me and many other viewers. What's Room 104? Because Game of Thrones, I understand, and that was spared, apparently.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't
spared.
Oh,
it wasn't spared. Oh, yes. It says here that apparently a script for the next episode set to air was also leaked. So we're going to be acting that out after the show, Michael, you and I. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. This has been going on for a long time. They're just reporting it more now. Movies and music and TV, perhaps less so TV shows, but movies and music have been leaked constantly for a long, long time. We're just paying more attention to it. And Room 104, by the way, is an anthology series set in a hotel room from the Duplass brothers.
Oh, okay. I like those guys. I should have known that. George Clooney, by the way, he once took on the paparazzi, threatening to boycott shows like Entertainment Tonight and magazines like People if they used photos snapped by aggressive, pushy freelancers who intrude onto celebrity lives. And that is an issue, at least here in Los Angeles. I'm sure it is in New York as well. Frank Sinatra later called to complain to Clooney, "It's not working," he said. Is that true? That can't be
true. Yes, yeah, it is true. There were helicopters flying over his house as they thought he was dying, and he said, "It's not working." And he was angry. He was angry at Clooney.
Well, now he's suing, Clooney that is, not Sinatra, is suing an Italian magazine after it published photos of his newborn children at their home in Lake Como. Of course, Lake Como being in Italy. Over the last week, he says, photographers from Voici magazine scaled our fence, climbed our tree, and illegally took pictures of our infants inside our home. Make no mistake. The photographers, the agency, and the magazine will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. The safety of our children demands it. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's sadly a big whoop, but that's, you know, it really is disgusting, you know? I mean, until people stop buying those magazines and looking at those pictures, it's never going to end. But celebrities really should just never give a single interview. If you're going to do that, why would they ever speak to this magazine or People magazine or Entertainment Tonight? They just have to not do business with them. Say, I won't talk to them ever.
And,
you know, and they have to stick to it.
They actually do that. I you know.
But it's not enough of it. No, I mean, you know.
Well, if you look, I mean, you know, Reese Witherspoon for years wouldn't speak to certain magazines. Because
I know everybody has their own personal vendetta. I mean, everybody has to stop speaking to anyone who ever does this. Not just because it hurts them, but they say, I'm not going to speak. Nobody should speak to Voici. You know, I mean, nobody should speak to any place trafficking. And it's disgusting. It's like, you know, they're going to their home to take a picture of their children. How horrifying is that? You know, you should be ashamed of yourself if you're looking at the photos.
Well, and if you know, are familiar with Lake Como, you'd know getting there and getting into a compound, it's not easy. It's not in a city. It's kind of semi-remote, near Milan, but not that close.
I don't care if they're, you know, half a mile away with a telephoto lens and you're on the beach. I just leave people alone.
Yeah, you know what? Go read some comic books, because comic books are a big business. Sure, you probably thought they always were, but comic books is a term embracing everything from mangas to graphic novels to comic strips to good old Spidey and Superman. Even though the New York Times just cut the bestseller list for comics, their popularity in this era continues to rise. In 2016, comic book sales hit $1 billion in North America, about $55 million ahead of the just over $1 billion of 2015. So a modest but solid 5% rise, with the biggest growth coming from graphic novel sales in traditional bookstore chains like Barnes & Noble. So maybe Barnes & Noble will become just a big giant book, you know, comic book store. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's good. It's a growing area. The really fascinating part is that the growth in traditional bookstores is coming from graphic novels geared towards kids, like middle school kids. These are original graphic novels telling the stories of like 12-year-old girls on summer vacation. Literally, there's a whole string of books geared to boys and girls in middle school and high school, and it's not about superheroes, not about whatever. They're like graphic novels telling stories, and there's huge superstars in this field. They're really, you know, generating a lot of sales and a lot of interest, and they're grabbing a lot of kids, and they're going to become fans for life, and those kids will grow up and be reading more and more comic books and graphic novels. So it's really exciting that they're developing these kids to learn and know, hey, reading comic books, graphic novels, whatever you want to call them, it's a worthy art form, it's fun, it's entertaining, and you're going to do this for life.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for the past 2 weeks, actually, and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
Stop! We can't do it. We're not ready.
Wait,
it's too big.
What, this story is too big?
Yeah, we're way behind on this story about The Walking Dead. It's a lawsuit that Frank Darabont, who was one of the people who launched The Walking Dead, is suing AMC, claiming they're screwing them out of profits. It's big. It's complicated. The story we're linking to came out a few weeks ago. There's so much juicy stuff in here. We just couldn't let it go. But it's so big and messy, we're kind of not even ready for it, are we?
No, I mean, look, at the end of the day, you're basically talking about, Frank Darabont, who is a director and screenwriter, and in this case, the creator of the show The Walking Dead, and he wrote the show. A lot of these emails were released that Frank Darabont wrote to AMC executives, and they were released kind of to embarrass Darabont because...
Part of court proceedings, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, they weren't released to embarrass him. They're part of the court record.
Right. Let's say he used some colorful language and he was really fighting for his show, which AMC unwisely decided to cut the budget of by 25%.
Now you're getting ahead of yourself. Yeah. So the show launched with like 6 episodes, huge hit. They had a season 2 coming up with like 13 episodes. And bizarrely, AMC said, we're going to cut the budget.
Right.
Of a show that was a monster out of the box hit. And so Frank Darabont is emailing back and forth, and not just about the budget, but all sorts of, and he's cursing, he's saying, these people, son of a beep, 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 you know, these incompetent son of a beep, 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 you know, and they're saying, look how unprofessional he is. And I'm like, really? Someone in Hollywood cursing? This is your idea of unprofessional? You'll have to fire half the agents and directors in Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there was a couple follow-up stories to this where producers and television network executives were asked, hey, look, is this unusual? Is this, you know, what do you think of this, these tirades that Darabont went on? And it was kind of a 60-40 split, with 60% saying, you know, look, he obviously was passionate. There are producers and writers and directors who talk like that. And there are executives who talk back like that. Committing it to writing may not be so smart. He was frustrated with a network that had a hit on its hands and had absolutely no idea how to handle it. They mishandled it. Everybody in the industry looks at AMC and says, wow, you really kind of messed this whole thing up. You're lucky to have survived, firing Darabont and the show going on. You're lucky.
Well, then they fired the next showrunner.
Right. In other words, you've done so much wrong here. You jumped out of the plane without a parachute and without a safety net, and yet you still survived. You're lucky. However, you mishandled it. Maybe Darabont is a little bit of a hothead.
Right. So, but on the other hand, AMC would say, well, yes, but we've got a hit show running into its, what, 7th season, 8th season. We've got a spinoff show, and we've made a ton of money off one of the biggest TV hits of all time. Truly, it was like the hottest show on television. It was bigger than anybody, bigger than Game of Thrones for a couple seasons. So they would say, you know, we're not doing so bad. But the issue at hand is, did they fire Frank Darabont just so they could not let him, you know, vest in an entire chunk of the show? If you did a certain number of episodes through the 2 seasons, he would be invested in a big chunk of the show. And they fired him just before he could be. And he says it wasn't for cause. It was just to prevent him from getting his fair share of the show that he helped create and turn into a monster hit. And one of the big things, and this is the really interesting thing, is they're, instead of getting into all the nuts and bolts of the contract, Darabont's lawyers are saying, look, this show has booked maybe $1 billion worldwide. That's a lot of revenue. And they say, you know what? It should have booked a lot more.
Yes, and because what they're saying is AMC Studios, okay, AMC Studios, which is the production company behind the show, is graciously giving AMC Network the show at like $1.75 million an episode. They're just gladly doing that because you know what? AMC Studios is owned by AMC Networks. Whereas, let's say, I don't know, Mad Men, which was owned by Lionsgate, after it was a hit and in its fifth, sixth, seventh season, all of a sudden, Lionsgate, which produced that show, was earning $4 million an episode to deliver that show to AMC. And so what you have here is Darabont's lawyers, and by the way, his agency, CAA, which actually put the whole show together and stands to earn 10% of that $1 billion, is turning around and saying, you're self-dealing here. This is vertical integration. You're supposed to be selling it to yourself at a fair market value. This has happened time and again in the TV space since the 90s when all of a sudden, you know, the networks and the studios could own their own production companies and sell to themselves. It happened with David Duchovny and the X-Files. It's happening here again, but with a much bigger show, with much more money at stake, with more players at stake. This is big not only for The Walking Dead and Frank Darabont and CAA, it's big for the entire industry.
It's another way, if it gets to a conclusion and there's a ruling before they settle out of court, it could have important implications for how you measure a show's success and compare it to other shows and what it should have made. And it's not just a question of, did you give me my fair share of the money you made? Did you also screw me by not making all the money you should have made? And my favorite little detail at the end of we got a whole mess of notes here, but you probably already read this story anyway, but we just couldn't resist. But my favorite detail is a little story about how the AMC CEO Josh Sapin's pay rose 323% to $40 million in 2014. Another is a 2012 conference call that Sapin conducted with stock analysts where he said, I mean, the standard rule on TV is if the show is successful, you'll pay more. If you are the studio, then you're paying yourself in many cases. So it's why we have such a strong bias toward owning.
Right.
Oops.
Yeah. I mean, executives do that all the time. And, you know, even we talked about AMC Cinemas, and luckily there was never any anything like that in any of those earnings calls, because Adam Aron, the CEO of AMC Cinemas, has always been very specific that they are a standalone company.
Right. So Sapin's like, look at all the money I'm making, you know, thanks to this big hit show. And then he also says, aren't we smart to own it? Because then we can keep more of the money ourselves.
Right. And so then, you know, Darabont and CAA, they brought in these expert witnesses that, you know, accounting wise are going in and saying, look, your production budget and your per episode cost should be mathematical. And they've gone into the math and the reasoning behind it and the percentage that it should cost, and showing, look, they should be at least $2.4 million an episode, not down at like 1.87. So at the very least, they are, you know, should be at 2.4, 2.5 million.
That's right. And there'll be obituaries once this case is all over. They'll dissect it and know what it means for the industry. And we'll follow that hopefully on a more timely basis. But it also brings us to the obituaries. A lot happened today. A couple people died just one after the other. Today we got notice that Jeanne Moreau, the famous legendary French actress, she died at 89. Most well known, of course, for starring in Francois Truffaut's Jules and Jim and many other films.
Yes, and then sadly, Sam Shepard died today from Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and actor. He died at the age of 73, to which I'd say that's young. You'd hope.
Nowadays, it sounds young, which is a nice thing.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is, you know, I was first introduced to him through The Right Stuff, actually. And, you know,
he was nominated for an Oscar for his performance.
Yes, but then, you know, he's True West. You know, his play True West, Buried Child. He's won a Pulitzer Prize for some of these. But I actually met him in Cannes doing a press for Don't Come Knocking, the Wim Wenders 2005 film. And we had like a great press day, and I was always fascinated by his career. He was an actor and, you know, in TV shows, and this like award-winning playwright. This he was seen as like maybe not
he's a cowboy who wrote plays and acted in movies. He was a movie star. He did it all. And Don't Come Knocking is the sequel to Paris, Texas, the film that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes.
That's right. And so we met there, and then maybe 6-7 months later, I saw him at Sundance for the same film. They brought that film to Sundance. And we had this lovely conversation. It lasted about 20 minutes about the differences between Sundance and Cannes. And he said, Cannes, you know, it was out of control. That film wasn't, you know, the film is okay, but, you know, it doesn't deserve that kind of applause for 20 minutes. And what are we doing? And about how he drove everywhere. He didn't like flying. So he drives from Kentucky, where he had a home, in Montana. And they would drive everywhere. And then, like maybe 6 years later, I saw him at the Getty Museum. And he actually remembered that conversation.
Oh, well, that was nice.
He was just such a nice, down-to-earth guy. But you're right. He's a cowboy playwright.
And he's such a man's man. He died of Lou Gehrig's disease, a baseball player's disease. No.
Yeah.
So sad death there, but not the only one. Even more tragic in a way, because they committed suicide, is Linkin Park singer Chester Bennington died. He hung himself, sadly. He was 41 years old. The band had just finished a new album, just put it out, and we're heading out on tour. So that's just very sad, tragic news. But again, one more reason people should talk more about depression and dealing with it. And if you're on medication, let people know that it's just a chronic condition that you have to deal with all your life. And the more open people are about it, the better everyone will be.
Yeah, you know, actually, there's a show on, and you might know this, Michael, because it was a one-man show. Chris Gethard did a show called Career Suicide, in which he talks about how he is severely depressed and how he didn't want to go on medication because, you know, medication is the thing that, you know, just saps your creativity and it'll take all your creativity away.
And it's not manly.
Yeah. And then he realized, oh, my God, I can't think straight without it, and that I'm far more creative when I'm on it. And he said, you know, somehow when it comes to mental illness, we look at medication and we say, oh, well, there's something wrong with you and you shouldn't have to take medication. But yet diabetes, you'd never say, oh, there's something
wrong. Or high blood pressure or anything.
Yeah, there's something wrong with you. You shouldn't have to take insulin. But, for you know, he actually talks about how medication is actually helpful, and the stigma against medication should kind of be, we should wean ourselves off of that. And so, to your point, Michael, yes.
And I have a couple friends who have talked to me in the last few years, and they're being more open with their friends about dealing with depression and being on medication. I'm like, that's awesome. Keep telling everybody.
Yeah. And, you know, again, there's some question, well, were drugs involved? Even if there were drugs involved, get help.
And two people connected to animation died. I shouldn't say that, really. I mean, Marty Sklar is really a Disney Imagineer, known more for the parks of Disney World. Disney just opened up, or at least previewed for critics, the Avatar park, the Pandora World. I just saw a big splashy piece in the Times about the Pandora element that they've opened up in Disney. And Marty Sklar would have been there, that's for sure. He's one of the last links directly to actual Walt Disney. He went from working on a newsletter for Disney to working with Walt directly on his own speeches. And he helped design and oversee a lot of Disneyland parks around the world, including Paris and Japan. He was the only person to have attended the opening of every Disney theme park from the beginning right up to Shanghai in 2016, and he died at 83.
That is amazing when you think about that. You know,
yeah, you know, I mean, you know, you think 73, they're how old? Oh, so young, 86. Like, that's a lot of time, you know, to cover from 60 years ago up to today. That's a lot of changes in the world that you see. And certainly June Foray saw a lot of changes. She was the queen of cartoons. She did voices, multiple voices on Rocky and Bullwinkle, the classic cartoon, including the voice of Natasha the Russian spy and Rocky the squirrel. She was one of the great voice actors alongside Mel Blanc and others. She did the Granny in Tweety and Sylvester cartoons and a lot of other Looney Tunes. She was Cindy Lou Who in How the Grinch Stole Christmas, a classic TV series. She died at 99, and that's a great career already, but she also did a couple really big things. One, she was arguably the major impetus behind the Annie Awards, which is an annual award for animation, back when no one paid attention to animation at all. And she served on the Academy Awards Board of Governors, you know, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. She served on the Board of Governors for 26 years. And for 20 of those years, she was pushing them to recognize animated films. And she finally achieved that. And that's why we have an Oscar for best animated movie, and probably more visibility for them, meaning that we finally have some animated movies get nominated for best picture. That's all due to June Foray, who died at 99.
However, she was thrown off at the age of 75 for not working for 10 years. And so,
you're kidding.
She was 99. So I'm kidding.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah.
Well, now, of course, if you have any comments or questions or feedback for us, you can let us know directly. You can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, something we just said was not doing so well. But still, please do subscribe to our show. That way you never miss an episode, and you can rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do that. And we love to hear from you. You can write to us again, or you can call us, or you can follow us on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Again, the website is showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, who is mgmt.com. Now, Michael, every week you have a new and exciting website for us to go to. What is it this week?
This week is whereisbriandunkelman.com.
I have no idea what that means, .com.
American Idol.
Okay, yeah. Well, I guess I'd have
someone buy him a drink when the new season begins. Just take him out, make sure the TV's turned off, and have a good night.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to the Huffington Post, or, I don't know, michaelgiltz.com is where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, you always have to stop by bookfilter.com to find out what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.